lived from 1225 AD to 1274 AD. He was a contemporary of Saint Bonaventure. You could actually give lectures. You could write books have been written comparing and contrasting Aquinas and Bonaventure, as well as Aquinas and Augustine, who lived about, 800 or 900 years earlier. The main difference between Augustine and Aquinas was that Augustine, they both believed the Bible was God's word, but Augustine based the foundation of his philosophical system of thought on Plato's thought, the world of ideas, taking the position of priority, the position of primacy, whereas Aquinas was Aristotelian. He followed Aristotle, that all knowledge begins in the world of the senses. Bonaventure tended to favor Augustine and Plato, but was willing to argue like an Aristotelian or a Thomist. He was willing to argue from the world of the senses. And I like that in him. He didn't see any logical or biblical reason why we couldn't come at it from both directions. But what I also liked about Bonaventure was he was willing to argue for the beginning of the universe using the Muslim Kalam cosmological argument, which was something that Aquinas was not willing to do because Aristotle believed in an eternal universe. And so he said, well, yeah, you can't prove that philosophically. We know that, though, because the Bible says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That's the way Aquinas would say. We know that by faith, not by reason. Whatever the case, his most famous work is Summa Theologica. He's got one of his works was, contradicting or refuting the Gentiles, refuting the pagans, basically. Tremendous work there. This guy wrote probably over 100 different works that we know of. But a good place to start is the Summa Theologica. However, it's so long, you'd have a hard time reading through it. You can get that in abridged form, and that might help you. There's been some really good Neo-Thomists that... or even Thomas, for that matter, followers of Aquinas that have translated and abridged some of his works. What you might be interested in doing is taking Peter Kreeft has, I think it's called something like a Summa of the Summa, something like that, where he takes portions of the Summa Theologica and then he has his own commentary underneath. He's pretty evangelical in his thought, though. He's Roman Catholic by faith. He teaches at philosophy at Boston College, but then he has like a shorter Summa of a Summa, which is even a bridge further, and gives you a good introduction. With Father, is it McInerney at Notre Dame, has that work, something like Aquinas for Peeping Thomas, so for people who aren't real deep into Aquinas, but they would like to take a little look into Aquinas' thought, he's got some really good works. Probably the best, it might be probably only a couple of different volumes, but the 9-volume set, Father Frederick Copleston, A History of Philosophy. Get the volume dealing with Augustine and the volume dealing with Aquinas, and there you probably have the best 100-page overview of Augustine and Aquinas, and Copleston was a Jesuit priest, and there's no way a guy who was married would have been able to write that stuff. There needed to be somebody who was going to get all his meals would be provided for him, and he wouldn't have to work other than just writing 20 hours a day, 7 days a week for, he lived into his 90s before he died. And in fact, he didn't die that long ago, probably a decade ago or something. In the 1940s, as a young Jesuit priest, he debated Bertrand Russell over the British Airways and blew Russell away in a debate. But Aquinas was influenced by Aristotle. He started with the same starting point. Aristotle was an empiricist. An empiricist, he starts with the world of the senses. A rationalist starts with innate ideas, believes we're created with innate ideas, okay? So Plato, rationalist, Aristotle, empiricist. Well, Aquinas followed Aristotle, and so he believed everything in the mind was first in the senses except the mind itself. So in other words, we start life as a blank slate. We come into life as a blank slate. There's nothing in our minds at all. It's like take this bag from, I think it's a bag from the Bon Marché. But it's like the receptive mind is there. Okay? And with the receptive mind, at the moment you're conceived, the receptive mind is there. Your mind is there. It's ready to receive knowledge. Okay? But there's nothing in your mind. No, you have the ability to know things, but it's empty. And as you have sense experience, then you start drawing, abstracting from sense data, rational principles that start going into the bag. Now, Aquinas could believe certain things were self-evidently true, but you would still realize those self-evident truths through sense experience. Whereas a rationalist would say something self-evidently true, and we know it even before the experience, though the experience may trigger it to our conscious minds. So the receptive mind is ready to receive truth, but it's the active mind is not like your mind is split in half, or you have two minds, an active mind and a receptive mind, but it's like your mind has two aspects to it. The receptive aspect, where you receive information, well, you start with no information. You start with no knowledge. You start as a blank slate. You start with no innate ideas. No ideas that you're born with, says Aquinas. But the active mind is the mind's ability to retrieve rational ideas and truth from sense experience. So you start life with no knowledge, but with the ability to attain knowledge through sense experience. So he has that distinction, the active mind and the receptive mind. And it's the receptive mind that's a blank slate. The active mind just is the mind's ability to gain knowledge. So it's irrelevant to ask if that's a blank slate or not. I mean, that's just that aspect of the mind is just the mind's ability to know something. But what the mind actually knows, zero, coming into life, says Aquinas. The distinctions that Aquinas draws, if you can get down his distinctions, it will help you to begin to understand his thought. Now, having said that, you know, I have a PhD in philosophy of religion, and I had to do a lot of reading in Aquinas, especially in master level work and my doctoral level work, and I feel like I have begun to understand Aquinas. So I don't claim to really know Aquinas real, real well. Now, Norman Geisler would claim to know Aquinas well and considers himself a Thomist. At the same time, every once in a while, I kind of wonder if he's making Aquinas a little more evangelical than he actually was. But certainly, Geisler understands Aquinas. The Notre Dame philosophers understand Aquinas. Peter Kreeft understands him. These guys have been studying him longer than I've been alive. If you can understand his distinctions, it will help you to start to figure him out. Just because it's a distinction doesn't mean that you have the right to make it a bigger distinction than he does. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. See, one of the big differences between Aquinas and Augustine, one of the things they had in common, they both dealt with God's natural revelation and his supernatural revelation. What God has revealed to us through nature, and we can know without miracles, but also what God has revealed to us supernaturally through miracles, what we can know through faith in God's revelation, supernatural revelation. They both focused on God's revelation to man, okay? Augustine's focus was, it's all revelation. Whether it's in nature or in the Bible, it's all revelation of God. So if I know that I'm sitting on a chair, that's because God revealed that to me, that I'm sitting on a chair. He illuminated my mind to understand it. He gave me the mind to be able to understand what a chair is, and created the universe in a reasonable way so that through reason I can figure things like that out. Okay? So Augustine is like, yeah, Augustine will talk about natural revelation and supernatural revelation, but his emphasis is it's all revelation. Aquinas will talk about possibly the most important distinction that he draws, or at least one of them, doctrines of reason and doctrines of faith. Doctrines of reason are things that we can learn through reason alone. We don't need supernatural revelation. And then doctrines of faith, where we can only learn those things from the Bible, from God's supernatural revelation. Now, what Aquinas is not doing, and what most Protestants think Aquinas is doing, Aquinas is not saying that if we learn something from natural revelation, therefore it's not revelation. We learned it through unaided human reason alone, and we don't need God's help with it. That's not what Aquinas is saying. He gets a bad rap on that. They're both dealing with God's revelation. It's just Aquinas is emphasizing the distinction between natural revelation, what he calls doctrines of reason, and supernatural revelation, what he calls doctrines of faith. His ministry, he was called to draw that distinction between the two. Whereas Augustine's emphasis was on pulling them both together. So, the biggest difference between Augustine and Aquinas, once you get beyond their epistemology, their theory of knowledge, one is Platonic, the other is Aristotelian, once you get beyond their theory of knowledge, for all practical purposes, the major distinction between the two is their point of emphasis. Okay? So they're not as far apart as people think. A good guy to go to on that is like Peter Kreeft. He could almost pull together Augustine, Aquinas, and Blaise Pascal. When most Protestant philosophers see them as all three of them as worlds apart from each other, and he pulls them about as close as you can get without really just whitewashing over the differences that are there. He'll when he's writing about Aquinas, he'll mention Augustine. In his book on the Poncès, he dedicates the book to Pascalian Thomas, and then he argues in the book in some of his notes on the Poncès that here is a point where Pascal's argument is coming very close to what Aquinas said. See, one of the biggest problems we have with Aquinas, not only do we need to bounce him off of Bonaventure and Augustine, but we also need to bounce him off of Descartes. And the average Protestant, the average evangelical today, and this drives Norman Geisler nuts, but the average evangelical philosopher from the Vantillian school, the Gordon Clark school, whatever it may be, they seem to distance Aquinas totally from Augustine and then put him in the same camp as Descartes, when René Descartes was an ultra-rationalist. I mean, he went even beyond Plato in his rationalism. And he thought you could prove everything through reason alone. And Aquinas wasn't even a rationalist. A lot of people will read into Aquinas' philosophy Cartesian rationalism, Descartes' rational thought. And that's a big, big mistake. So Francis Schaeffer, for instance, who was trained by Van Til, he blames Thomas Aquinas for forming the foundation of secular humanism and leading ultimately to the Enlightenment. And it's like, Francis Schaeffer, was a great thinker, but that was probably the biggest mistake in his thought. He got it directly from Van Til. No, it's when the start of modernism is when Descartes said, we can prove everything through reason alone and solve all our problems through human reason. Where all of a sudden supernatural revelation was swallowed up by natural revelation. And see, this is one of the reasons why I'm a young earther, not an old earther, is because I believe supernatural revelation, God's revelation in the scripture, is clearer than God's revelation to us in nature. We have become experts at perverting and twisting God's revelation of himself and his truth to us through nature. So God decided, well, then I have to write a book that's even clearer. So when an old earth creationist, God bless him, Hugh Ross, comes on the scene and acts like we need to turn to natural revelation and science to interpret Genesis chapter 1 in a different way than it's been interpreted for the past 1800 years, I disagree. I think Genesis 1 is a lot clearer than any of the reigning scientific theories, or this is whatever the scientific consensus may be right now. So, see, most Protestants that don't like Aquinas will say that Aquinas believed you could prove everything through reason alone. That's Descartes. Is that Aquinas? No. I even butt heads with one of the guys from Worldview Academy. Great guy. I don't want to mention his name. But he argued that Aquinas taught that you could prove everything through reason alone. It's like, no, one of the biggest aspects of Aquinas' thought was his distinction between doctrines of faith and doctrines of reason. And doctrines of faith, you could not, like the Trinity, you could not prove them through reason alone. Even Francis Schaeffer and Cornelius Van Til argued from reason alone for the doctrine of the Trinity. Yet, they're supposed to be the humble apologist, and Aquinas is supposed to be the know-it-all guy. But Aquinas, even if you understand his analogical predication, we'll talk about that in a little bit. There's a humility in Aquinas' thought that he just does not get credit for. See, Aquinas not only taught... See, you'll have evangelicals that will act like Aquinas believed he could prove, he could know everything there is to know about God, and everything there is to know, and do it all through reason alone. No, that is totally not Aquinas. Even Descartes wouldn't go that far. But Aquinas would say, look, not only can we not know everything there is to know about God, because you have to be God to know that, but even everything that we know, every truth that we know, whether it's about God or His creation, we only know in a finite way. But God knows every truth infinitely. So Aquinas is so humble that even the truth that we know, he describes them as arrows going towards the bullseye of the target, but we're never really quite sure exactly how close it gets. So there's a humility in Aquinas' thought that, if anything, he acknowledges the mysterious aspect of God almost to the point where it scares you to read it if you understand what he's saying, because he almost sounds a little too skeptical. But they act like he's too dogmatic. Whatever the case, so he's got the distinction between the active mind and the receptive mind. The active mind, that's the mind's ability to know. The receptive mind, that's just the mind collecting ideas and knowledge that are abstracted from sense experience. Also, he has a distinction between act and potency, or the actual realm and the potential realm. I actually do exist. Phil Fernandez actually exists. I'm in the actual realm. I know it's hard to believe, but I could have potentially, if God chose, I could have had a twin brother. He would have been as good looking, as tall as me. But I could. But that's a potential being. A being that's... It's not a contradiction to say that Fernandez could have had a twin. But the fact is, I don't have a twin. My twin Elvis died. No. I actually exist. My potential twin doesn't exist, but it's a potential being. An impossible being would be like a square circle. Okay? Or a human who is a non-human in the same way at the same time. I mean, it's just a contradiction. Contradictions can't exist. But he has that distinction between the actual realm, the potential realm. And then actual beings have potency. They have potential to do things. It's really weird, too. If I understand Aquinas correctly, God has infinite potential to do. He can do everything that is possible to do. So he has infinite potential to do. That's what omnipotence means. Okay, the word potency is right in there. Yet God has no potential... You gotta hear me out on this. In Aquinas' thought, God has infinite potential to do, but no potential to exist. And what he means by that is, God is pure actual existence. See, we needed our potential to exist. We were possible, ideas in God's mind, and God actualized our possible existence by actually creating us, God had no potential to exist that needed to be actualized. He is pure, actual, necessary, infinite existence. So God is pure act. Everything else that exists has an actual pole and a potential pole. Our potential to exist was actualized by God. The repercussions of this are phenomenal, because a cup has the potential to hold coffee, yet the cup doesn't have the potential to fill itself with coffee. Potentialities cannot actualize themselves. Kind of a way that I talk, I try to break this down with some Japanese students we had a year or two ago. They were Buddhists, so they believed that the world just popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. I asked, well, how did everything get here? I said, I believe God made everything. And then I asked them, their English wasn't very good, so I had to break things down. And I asked them, how did everything get there? And one of them said, Big Bang. And I said, well, how did the Big Bang get here? And they said, they talked amongst each other in Japanese, and then one said, you say miracle. And I said, no, I'm allowed to have miracles, because I believe in God, a miracle working God. You don't have God, you don't have no miracles. So what caused what made everything? And they talked to each other, and then one of the girls, the spokeslady for the girls said, nothing. And so I looked out my window, and you could see the weight room from my classroom, and I said, I have the power. Power is potency. Power is potential to do things. I have the power to lift weights. And they said, oh, weights, yeah. And they talked with each other. And I said, but I don't have the power to make everything. Then I said, nothing doesn't have the power to lift weights. But you say nothing made everything? And then they didn't want to talk anymore. But you see how potential power is being used. So Aquinas makes this a big thing. God, when it comes to existing, God is pure act with no potency, no potential to exist. He's pure actual existence. So no, we have existence because God gave it to us. God is existence. And I really think if he really followed this out, he believed God's a necessary being, but he believed God is existentially necessary, not rationally necessary. But I think there's just a small jump from existential necessity. In other words, God has to exist for anything to be actual. There has to be necessary existence as the ground, pure actual existence, as the ground for all the existence that has both act and potency, finite existence, dependent, contingent existence, existence that is the beings that depend on something else for their continued existence. But I think there's a small jump from existential necessity, from actual necessity, to ontological necessity, to rational necessity. Anselm would say God has to exist by definition. A necessary being must exist as a contradiction for a necessary being to not exist. Aquinas can't go there because all knowledge starts with the senses. I don't think he should have locked himself in the Aristotelian cage. Another distinction he draws very close to that is essence and existence. Essence is what you are. Existence is that you are. My twin brother has an essence, a definition, okay, but the fact of the matter is my twin brother is just an idea, a potential idea that was never actualized, so has no existence. But I do exist. I have an essence. I have human nature, and I actually do exist. Since God is his attributes, that's what it means when Aquinas and traditional philosophers call God a simple being. See, we are beings who have attributes. God is a simple being, so he can't be separated from his attributes. God is his attributes. So we have holiness, God is holiness. We have love, God is love. We have existence, God is existence. We are very close, even starting with an Aristotelian starting point, we're still very close to Anselm's ontological argument. If God is existence, it's impossible for existence to not exist, because then it wouldn't be existent. But whatever the case, Aquinas will not go there. He has to start with the world of the senses. Aquinas is an essentialist in that God's essence, it is God's essence to exist, but the opposite of an essentialist would be an existentialist. An existentialist, existence precedes essence. An essentialist, your essence precedes your existence, not in time, but basically, so an essentialist says that you come into existence already defined. You already have a defined nature. You have boundaries. You can't just jump off your roof and start flying like a bird, because you're not a bird. You don't have the potential to fly by flapping your appendages. The existentialist, like Jean-Paul Sartre, would say, no, existence precedes essence. He would say, there is no God, so man is totally free to define his essence. So our existence, our choices, they define who we are. So we come into the world as a blank check, and we fill in the blanks with the choices we make. We actualize ourselves through an act of our will. Aquinas is an essentialist. It's a traditional thinkers, even non-Christian traditional thinkers are essentialists. No, we come into life defined, and our existence is important, but our existence, the choices we can make, the things we can do are determined to a large degree by who we are, or what we are, our essence. But Aquinas will really go to town on these as well, the distinction between essence and existence. Now, Aquinas believed that the first principles of knowledge are self-evident. If you're going to start thinking, you've got to start somewhere. And so Aquinas would say, these are the first principles of knowledge, and that they're self-evidently true. Now here he sounds like a rationalist, so he sounds like he's contradicting his empiricism, but he's not. First principles of knowledge does not necessarily mean that they're innate ideas that you're born with. It doesn't mean that they're ideas you can know apart from sense experience, but he believes that these first principles of knowledge are kind of our ability to know, our active mind, once we have our first sense experience, our mind's ability, we can start then not only thinking about the sense experience, but we can start thinking about thinking. So from the sense experience, we could find these self-evident truths. But you still have to have the sense experience first, Aquinas would say. To be totally honest with you, I don't find that very convincing. I would be more on the rationalist, Platonic side there. I think when you look at two things of equal size, these two books of equal size, Aquinas would say that we got our idea of equality from our first sense experience of two equal things. I would agree with Augustine or Plato, who would say that when we have our first experience of two equal things, we wouldn't be able to bring the idea of equality out of them unless it was already in the packaging of the mind. So in other words, we've got this innate idea, even if it's in our unconscious, subconscious form, that the sense experience triggers from the unconscious mind, and so we look and we say, oh, those two things are equal in size. But you don't get that from sense. If you want to see what you get from sense experience, even with Aquinas' active mind, if you want to see what you get, actually we get from sense experience, read David Hume, who's an empiricist who kind of builds on Aquinas' foundation, and he ends up with total skepticism. Because, you know, it's just like, you know, Aquinas is using the law of cause and effect, the law of causality, to argue for God's existence. David Hume, I think, is a more consistent empiricist and says there's nothing in sense experience that teaches us the law of causality. We don't learn that from sense experience. Just because when you have a pool stick and you hit the white ball, the cue ball, and it hits the eight ball and the eight ball goes in the pocket, it doesn't mean that you caused the white ball to hit the eight ball. It means that they just follow in that order over and over again. He said, you know, the rooster crows and the sun rises day after day after day. They're in constant conjunction. They constantly come in the same order, but the rooster crowing does not cause the sun to rise. So we have no idea. We have no way. We read into it. One thing causes the other thing, and sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong. But, you know, it's like if Mike Tyson hits somebody clean, the guy goes down. We just read into it, well, Mike, the punch caused the guy to go down. But there really, we have no way of knowing if there really was a cause and effect thing from empiricism. But that would cause me, contrary to David Hume, that would cause me to cease to be an empiricist and say, okay, then we have certain, in the packaging of the mind, we have these certain innate ideas that enable us. And the way Gordon Clark puts this with Thomas Aquinas is big on God revealing his moral laws to us through nature in our conscience, okay? Gordon Clark just shoots that down in one sweeping statement by saying, you will never, no matter how active the active mind is, you'll never get moral laws, absolute moral laws, from a mound of dirt. What he's saying is, no matter how many sense experiences you have, you're never going to get one moral law unless those moral laws were written on your hearts from the start. And that's what Romans 2, 14 and 15 seems to say. By the way, let me say this before I forget, in case because we're going to be spending a few lectures on Aquinas, and I don't want to be mistaken here. I think evangelical philosophers, most evangelical philosophers, are way too tough on Aquinas' philosophy, and they make it the philosophy of man, and this and that. And I'm not a Thomist. I like Aquinas' arguments, but I'm not an empiricist. I have a different epistemology, a different theory of knowledge. I'm not forced to start with the world of the senses. I'm more of a rationalist, but I'm what I would call a humble rationalist who realizes that even human reason and the truths we can find are all dependent upon God. So it's not unaided human reason. Most evangelicals are way too hard on Aquinas' philosophy and act like it's a humanistic philosophy. No, it's not. Okay? Having said that, I mean, he basically, when he baptized Aristotle's thought, you know, he threw out what just was contrary to the scriptures from Aristotle. And when he baptized Aristotle's thought, he held the boy underwater for a long, long time. And as long as, if not longer, than Augustine did with Plato's thought. Having said that, those few evangelicals who like myself, Aquinas' philosophy, even if they don't agree with him on every point, tend to be too generous in their assessment of his theology. So what I'm saying is, Aquinas, and by the way, Augustine, the reformers didn't want to admit it, and most reformed scholars today don't want to admit it, but St. Augustine, as early as he was very, very Roman Catholic. He loved relics. He loved the sacraments. He believed you received saving graces through infant baptism. Augustine and Aquinas were very, very Roman Catholic when it came to their theology. And so it is just not consistent for an evangelical to argue that Roman Catholicism is a perversion of biblical Christianity and then give Aquinas and Augustine a free ride. And I do believe, you know, I think there are many Roman Catholics who are saved, but that's despite the Roman Catholic thought that says that we're not saved, we're not justified through faith alone, and you've got the saving graces of Calvary coming to us through the sacraments and the priesthood and things of that sort. So basically, they're too gentle on Aquinas when it comes to theology if they like his philosophy, but most evangelicals don't like his philosophy. I think he's got a lot to offer philosophically speaking. Theologically speaking, you know, there's a lot to be desired there. He's got like 1,200 years of man twisting God's word and human tradition, and Augustine, I don't know, Augustine started a lot of the garbage. So I know there's going to be some people say, oh, listen to this new kid on the block slamming Aquinas and Augustine, but the fact of the matter is, these guys had some real problems when it came to clear biblical teaching. I think anybody who prays to the saints, you might be saved, but you have problems there, okay? So the first principles of knowledge, they're self-evident, self-evidently true. We don't need to argue for them, we just know they're true when we start having sense experiences, okay? I would be taking more of a rationalistic thing. Those ideas are there even before the sense experiences. But there's the law of identity. See, what we're dealing with now, a large portion of philosophy is thinking about thinking. But I remind people, when they don't like philosophy, which is thinking about thinking, philosophy is one of those things that we can do that may, in some degree, reflect God's image, because it's one of the things that separates us from the animal kingdom. Animals can think. Michael Heiser, I'm really glad in a lot of what he's saying about animals' ability to reason, their ability to think, when he talks about the image of God, that a lot of what we call the image of God in man, animals also have. My dog can use the law of non-contradiction. Okay? If I put a dog biscuit in this hand, shuffle it around, if I go like that, and my dog goes there, if I go like that, immediately my dog's nose goes here. It's either here or it's there, but it's not in both. If it's not here, it must be there. My dog will use some of these first principles. So my dog can think to a certain degree. So when we say that what separates the humans from animals in the area of thinking is human reason, okay? Well, really what it comes down to, we reason on a higher level than they do, but they do a certain amount of reasoning themselves. A lot of people deny that. And I tell you, if Christians keep denying it, we're going to look ugly. The more studies we do with animals, when animals start learning sign language and all this other stuff, and I'm not even sure how far it goes with that, but the fact of the matter is, animals do think, but what they don't do, they don't think about thinking. And see, Aquinas was on the Aquinas even acknowledged that animals have souls. How many evangelicals are like, oh, animals don't have souls, that's foolishness. The Bible calls them living souls. Just because our translations today translate living beings, we act like they don't have souls. No, it's the same word for soul used of humans is used of them. All the soul is the life principle. Amen. Now, our soul was created not only to put us in contact with the world of the senses, but also to enable us to fellowship with God. So our souls, because of their purpose, continue to exist after the death of our bodies. An animal soul is only created, God only created it to put them in touch with the world of the senses. So when their body dies, the soul dies with it. The life principle is just totally gone. If humans don't like thinking about thinking, fine. Okay? But don't slam me and philosophers for thinking about thinking, because it's one of those things that separates us from the dogs, from the animals. Now, there are other things. Morality separates us from the animals. Dogs, they don't really experience guilt. When my dog looks guilty and is... When my dog today ran away with her friend Stitch, and I was calling, she doesn't come back and stuff. So then I had to go use the restroom. When I came out, I opened the door, and she's waiting by the door for me. Well, when I opened the door, she's like 6 inches lower to the ground than she normally is. So she looks real guilty when she's walking by me, okay? But that's not guilt. Guilt is when you acknowledge, I have done wrong. I have really done something that is universally wrong. She's not thinking I've done something wrong. She's in the stage where when I do this, when I come back after running away with Stitch for a half hour, and then I come back, my master usually yells at me and puts me in my cage and then locks it up. So it's all, I do this and this happens. It's got nothing to do with feeling guilty. You know, once I leave the house, she's in her cage. She's just like, oh, good, he's gone. With us, it's more than just, you know, it's more than just a pragmatic thing. With them, it's a pragmatic thing. When I do this, bad things happen. So there's lots of things that separate us from the animals. The biggest thing that separates us from the animals is the fact that they cannot fellowship with God. And we can commune with God. Another big thing, you know, God put, it's almost saying the same thing in Ecclesiastes, God put eternity in our hearts. We think about eternity. Animals don't think about, you know, death. And